Earlier this month, Rick Juergens retired as CEO and chairman of Hy-Vee after 43 years with the company. The Iowa-based supermarket chain operates 235 stores in 8 states. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In the first half hour today, we'll hear from Rick Juergens about the evolution of Hy-Vee and trends in the grocery business. Then later in the hour, we'll talk about healthy eating and changes to school lunch menus, changes which take effect this year. We'll be joined by dietitian Kathy Garris and nutrition specialist Ruth Litchfield. The origins of that smile in every aisle, right after this news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Now, if you don't recognize that jingle, I'm going to guess perhaps you just beamed down from another planet, or perhaps a less startling explanation, you're just new to Iowa or to the Midwest. My guest this half hour is Rick Juergens. He's just retired as the CEO and chairman of Hy-Vee after 43 years with the company. He joins us from our studios in Des Moines. Rick Juergens, welcome to our program.
Thank you, Ben. It's a pleasure to be with you.
We wanted to have our listeners join in this hour, this half hour, with Rick Juergens and tell us, what are the aspects of supermarkets that are most important to you? Or perhaps what do you find most annoying when you go grocery shopping that people like Rick Juergens need to find a solution for? 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. You can email us, river2river at iowapublicradio.org. Hy-Vee was founded in 1930. Today, Iowa's largest supermarket chain, an employee-owned corporation, 235 stores in 8 states, some 62,000 employees. Rick Juergens, tell us the story of how Hy-Vee first started.
Well, it's pretty typical of a lot of supermarket chains of the same vintage, a small collection of privately owned stores banded together to form a chain. And since they were all individual owners and entrepreneurs, they decided to have joint ownership and ultimately let the employees join in on that. The original stores were called everything from Hyde stores to Vredenburg to supply stores, and didn't actually become Hy-Vee until 1952 with an employee contest.
And then that's where the name comes from. You mentioned Hyde and Vredenburg. That's where Hy-Vee comes from.
Correct. It's just an abbreviation of the two names. And it came about, ironically, during a day and time when there were a lot of chains with somewhat sing-songy types of names. You may recall Hinky Dinky, and there's still some Piggly Wigglies around and that sort of thing.
Right.
And I didn't work for Hy-Vee when I first heard of it and thought it was one of those names. But to me, today, it's one of the most beautiful sounds in the world.
Okay. So before that, give us some context. I know this is before your time. You go back 40-some years in the organization. But let's talk a little bit more about Hy-Vee's origins. Some context for supermarkets in the middle of the 20th century when Hy-Vee got its foothold. A supermarket was still a fairly new idea, wasn't it?
It was. In fact, there were no supermarkets in the 30s when we were founded. They were all little general stores where people stood behind a counter, and even a can of pork and beans was handed to you from a shelf by a clerk. There was very little self-serve at all in those days, and supermarkets really didn't come around in earnest until around the 50s. So I think our first supermarket was in Centerville, Iowa, actually. And by today's standard, that would be somewhat common and old-fashioned. But in those days, it was very much a supermarket.
235 stores in 8 states, Hy-Vee now. Which of the 8 states? Can you name them?
Well, I can. Iowa, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Illinois, Kansas, Missouri, Nebraska, South Dakota.
Okay. Hy-Vee has obviously been tremendously successful. What are the reasons you can point to for that success?
You know, it's a great question, Ben, and I think the most important thing is that we have a culture. We believe there's a certain way that people should be treated, and it came from our founders and has been taught to all of us through the generations of Hy-Vee, not unlike a family would teach principles and values. And we believe that you need to be honest and friendly and respectful, dedicated, and not just to customers, which is somewhat intuitive, but also that to each other and to our vendors and to our communities and to everyone we come in contact with. And I think that was probably the foundation of why our company has succeeded. You couple that with employee ownership and being privately owned. So every decision we make is based on the long-term best interests of our customers, our employees, and our communities. We don't have to deal with the rigors of the marketplace as it relates to what private companies or public companies deal with. We don't have market analysts evaluating the value of our company, for example. And so we're able to make decisions really, we think, in best long-term interest, which ultimately results in companies that last a long time.
Rick Juergens is with us, just retired as the CEO and chairman of Hy-Vee after 43 years of service with the company. If you have a question or a comment, river2river at iowapublicradio.org. Our email, 1-866-780-9100, toll-free number, or you can reach us with a tweet at IPR Talk. Tom from Iowa City has this email on a point you just mentioned, Rick Juergens. Hy-Vee promotes itself as employee-owned, but non-management employees do not own stock or sit on the board of directors. Some management employees are granted stock but have to sell it back when they retire or leave the board. There is no union at Hy-Vee. In what way is Hy-Vee employee-owned? Asks Tom from Iowa City.
Sure. Well, that's a great question. And actually, I'm guessing at the number off the top of my head, but some 15,000 employees own stock through the 401k. A certain amount of their 401k contribution from the company is given to them in Hy-Vee stock. The store directors, executive staff, and officers of the company buy stock directly, and then are required, those employees are required to sell that back over a 10-year period after they retire. So I'm in that 10-year buyout right now. So virtually anyone who qualifies to be in the 401k, which is, I believe, 19 years of age, is able to own a small piece of the company.
So it's not just management?
No.
It's any employee. If you're stocking shelves, you own a part of the company?
If you're contributing to the 401k and thus receiving a Hy-Vee match, you are receiving some ownership of the company.
Tell us, what do you see as the biggest milestones in Hy-Vee's, I guess it's an 80-year-plus evolution? How has Hy-Vee changed?
Well, obviously we've had a multitude of changes in terms of format. You know, our stores are much, much larger. For example, when I first came to the company in 1969, I went to work in 71 at Muscatine in a brand new store that was 18,000 square foot, was a fairly large store for our company at that point. Today, our stores will be 80 to 100,000 square foot. So there are dramatic changes. The original store that I worked in had four departments. Today, there'll be 25 or more departments in the store. So dramatic changes there. Of much more significance, I think, is that our company has not changed in our ownership structure, in our belief system, our value structure, and in our zeal to make a difference in the world. And those things have remained constant and really been a big factor in our evolution.
1-866-780-9100 to talk with Rick Juergens, former CEO, retired CEO and chairman of Hy-Vee. Let's go to Doug, who's joining us from Davenport. Hi, Doug.
Hey, how are you guys?
We're doing great. Do you have a question or a comment?
Just a comment. I was just kind of wondering, with the advent of technology and the mobile apps, do you think we're going to be heading in a direction where you could possibly, you know, order your items online, have a personal shopper actually do the shopping for you, to where all you have to do is pull up and pick up your items and pay? I'll take my answer off the air.
Great question, Doug. The Hy-Vee and the digital age. What has happened? What will happen?
Well, thanks for that question, Doug. And actually, I'm embarrassed to say that we already do that in many of our stores and possibly even in a store near you. We maybe haven't done as good a job in publicizing it, but we do have stores who actually will take an order either online or over the phone, fill the order, and even deliver it in some cases if that's appropriate. We've had some people that were shut in for a variety of reasons and couldn't get out, and so we're happy to accommodate them to the best of our ability. I think you'll see that grow over time as more and more people become acclimated to shopping online, and that's clearly a growth area. We just launched a new app for mobile apps for people with iPhones and Androids that they can actually, while they're in the store, locate an item by punching in toothpicks, and it will take them right to the item in the store. We're very excited about that, and that's part of the continuum. We just continue to try to respond to the needs and wants of our consumers, and as consumers demand and expect more from technology, we're going to try to be there to deliver it for them.
When you look back over the decades, you have 4+ decades to look after over. How would you compare the way a consumer for food shops for food today with how they shopped a generation or two ago? How have we as food consumers, shoppers, changed the way we go down those aisles? Well, we just mentioned the digital thing where you don't even have to go down the aisle. I guess you go down a virtual aisle at home, right?
Correct. And there have been other changes. One of the more fascinating things, in the early stores, there was a very clear traffic pattern for a consumer. They would come in the stores, they would go down the odd aisles and up the even aisles. And frankly, the preponderance of customers did that. They would go up and down each aisle getting the various things they needed, sometimes skipping the aisle, but they would still go through the exercise. Today, people come in from two separate entrances, and they go every direction possible depending on their needs. And sometimes they have a destination shop where they're going to the pharmacy or to the floral department or simply going to one of the food service departments to take food home with them. And so their traffic pattern in the store is dramatically different and virtually impossible to predict.
How does that change your design, your layout of what products, what areas you put where?
Yeah, well, that's a great question, and it creates a constant challenge. But what we try to do, what we've come to is, we believe we should try to set the store to suit the consumer. And there's a temptation in any retail chain to try to set it to sell them what we want them to buy. And we just don't find that to be as successful. So what we try to do is anticipate their needs. So, for example, there's a number of ways you could set a section within the store, like peanut butter and jelly. And so we try to make it so if they're looking at the peanut butter section, they can see everything in that section easily and do their price comparisons and their quality comparisons and make those decisions easily and quickly. Speed is a priority to our consumers today, and they're time crunched, and so we have to do that. Now, I'll take that same category and be a little bit contradictory, but for the same reason. If you're looking for organic peanut butter, for the most part, you will find that in our health market because we find the organic consumer likes the convenience of all of the organics being compressed into one area. So they don't need to travel the entire store to find just organic products. And the typical organic customer today doesn't buy organic only, but they have certain items where they will only buy organic.
Organics are here to stay.
Oh, yes. Fastest growing category in our stores for the last 10 or 12 years.
Rick Juergens, former CEO, retired CEO, and chairman of Hy-Vee after 43 years with the company. A Twitter question from one of our listeners, Rob. Rob writes, I noticed that Hy-Vee's prices are consistently higher than other chains like Fairway. What do you attribute that to?
Well, you know, I think if you take an overall market basket at Hy-Vee, you will find us to be very competitive. We have a number of things that we do to create our value structure for our customers. There's everyday pricing, and we work hard to be as aggressive as we can. We also have something temporary price declines in which either store by store or through value we create with vendors, we can lower the price. And then we do a great deal of advertising. And those ad prices, when shop can drive our prices well below the market. And so we think we obviously give a value proposition, or we wouldn't be able to succeed as well as we have over the last several years, which has been the worst economic situation I've seen in my 43 years in the business. And yet our company was able to grow and add stores and jobs. And we think we provide a great value to our consumers.
There's a lot of talk about, in politics at least, about regulations being a problem in the commercial sector, about it limiting job growth or stymieing job growth. Are there any regulations, I wonder, that you think are especially burdensome and have little value in retailing of food?
You know, it's not so much the regulations, it's the administration of them that adds cost to food. And so what we've tried to do at Hy-Vee, I had the privilege of serving as the chairman of the Food Marketing Institute, which is the largest trade organization in the world in the food business. And we've worked very hard in the FMI to try to work out ahead of key issues that are going to affect consumers and either work with the government or even ahead of the government when appropriate to try and provide what's needed without the regulation. So, for example, we just developed over the last few years a front-of-pack labeling concept, which we think will help consumers make better choices on the products they purchase, especially if they're interested in the nutritional value of them. And so companies around America, including Hy-Vee, we were the first retailer to begin that implementation on our private label products, are implementing that ahead of the government. We didn't wait for government regulation to develop it. And as a result, we can do it, we think, more cost-effectively and efficiently and really provide consumers what they want at the end of the day. I will say, to be honest with you, regulations can be frustrating, even irritating, and sometimes feel punitive. But at the end of the day, we all have to deal with them. And so our attitude at Hy-Vee has always been to try to live to the letter of the law and beyond. I can tell you that, for example, with food safety inspections, we've developed a process that is much more rigorous than what the inspectors who come into our stores have. And that way we think we're living up to our responsibility of doing everything we can to provide safe food to consumers.
Is there one, if you had to choose, one regulatory change you could make, what would most benefit Hy-Vee that you would choose?
You know, I'm not sure I could answer that question. I'm not wild about a number of them, but none of them are.
For instance?
Well, like cool. The country of origin labeling, great idea. It lets consumers know where products come from. But without getting into all the nitty-gritty, which we don't have time for, the details and the cost of technology to track what the government expects us to track to be able to respond to questions that they have is just frankly raising the price of food. There's an example where I think the legislation is fine. The bureaucracy behind it is excessive and creating more cost than is necessary. But frankly, our industry, if we'd address that appropriately ourselves, we wouldn't have had to deal with the government issue. And that's why we're trying to be more proactive in anticipating consumers' needs and wants.
Rick Juergens, CEO and chairman of Hy-Vee, retired after 43 years. A final 5 minutes. Here's a nice email from Sarah in Davenport listening to our program. She writes, I recently moved back to the Quad Cities. While away, I lived in Georgia and New York. One of the things my husband and I missed most was Hy-Vee. You don't realize how much the culture of their stores affect your grocery shopping until you're in a Kroger and the employees huff at you when you ask them a question or bring a full cart to their checkout. Okay, so much for Southern hospitality. I'll take Midwest culture any day of the week. There you go. You can use that for some promotion.
Sarah, that's very kind of you, and let me just welcome you back to Iowa. This state's going to be a lot better off with someone as nice and kind-hearted as you are. I appreciate it a lot.
You know, everyone around the office today, because we had some Hy-Vee, various versions of the Hy-Vee jingle out, have been whistling or humming it. Do you have a whistling, humming, or singing version of the Hy-Vee melody?
Is there something you don't like about your consumers or your customers and listeners, Ben?
you're telling me you don't do it very well, huh?
No, I've loved the jingle forever, and obviously it's such a key part of our company. In fact, you'll see it in some upcoming commercials that they're working on. It's going to be emphasized a little bit more. We feel like we've been a little bit negligent in letting people hear it. It's almost a part of Iowa history, as most of us know it, and so we want to keep it alive, and hopefully you'll hear it sung by a lot better singers than I am.
Okay, a couple quick things before we have to go, Rick Juergens. In fiscal year 2011, Hy-Vee total sales of $7.3 billion ranks among the top 25 supermarket chains in the U.S. Where to from here? Any room for expansion into other states, more stores?
Certainly, although our long-term plans at this point primarily involve filling in voids. For example, we only have one store in Wisconsin today. Well, there are a lot of towns between here and Madison where our first store went that we can add Hy-Vees. Plus, we'll probably have at least two more stores in Madison. We'll continue to expand into Illinois, Missouri, and other states. Minnesota, before we venture out into others. But, you know, it's always a possibility. If the right opportunity confronted us, we might venture into another state. But the advantage to us is leveraging our existing facilities and staffing by sort of growing city to city rather than leapfrogging out to Florida or Georgia or that sort of thing.
Okay, we have just about a minute left. Rick Juergens, you've been with Hy-Vee for 43 years. You're now retiring. What are your plans for retirement?
Well, you don't have time for that, but I've already been this week to a guitar lesson and art lesson. I've been rowed in an eight-man sweep rowing boat, played golf. I've boated, kayaked, and played with my grandchildren. I'm going to the baseball game tonight. It's going to be a little wild and woolly, but I'm going to have a lot of fun. And most importantly, I'm staying involved with the Healthiest State Initiative. I promised the governor I'd help make Iowa the healthiest state in America, and I'm going to live up to that promise, and we're going to make that happen.
So you're taking guitar lessons. What type of music do you like to play?
Well, mostly...
Or want to play. Perhaps you're really at the early stages and you can't pick a genre quite yet until you get through the basics.
No, I've actually written two songs as well. One was a blues tune and the other was a song for my wife, Carol, that I played at our... I didn't play it myself. I had my guitar instructor sing it at my retirement dinner. And so kind of in the rock and blues sort of genres, I guess, most comfortable.
With such a successful career, what does Rick Juergens have to sing the blues about or write a blues song about?
Yeah, it was just for the fun of doing it. It was, and it wasn't about me. It was about a guy I made up who lost his girlfriend, and the name of the song is Hot Water. It's a lot of fun.
Did he meet her in a supermarket aisle by chance?
Well, probably not in the Hy-Vee aisle, or he wouldn't have lost her, because in this song he loses her. So,
all right, we won't hear that song. We'll hear a more familiar song as we go out. Rick Juergens, retired CEO and chairman of Hy-Vee, 43 years of service. Rick Juergens, thank you for this conversation. We wish you all the best, you and your family, upon your retirement. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Good luck to you too, Ben.
Thank you very much. When we come back, can you mandate healthy foods or ban at least unhealthy foods? We'll talk about that when we return. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In this half hour, we want to talk about healthy eating, changes to school lunch menus that are coming. Parents, take note. Changes that will take effect this year. Joining us to do that, Kathy Garris is a dietitian for Hy-Vee in Iowa City, previously catering manager at the University of Iowa Hospital's Dietary Department and director of student nutrition at a different time at the Regina Education Center in Iowa City. Kathy Garris, welcome to our studio.
Thank you very much.
Also joining us by phone, once again on the program, she's been on a couple times, Ruth Litchfield, Associate Professor in the Department of Food Science and Human Nutrition at Iowa State University in Ames, also an ISU Extension Nutrition Specialist. Ruth, welcome back to our program.
Yeah, great to be here.
We want to reach out to our listeners also this hour. Your questions about nutrition and diet. What are your techniques for eating healthy? Maybe you have a special rule or a habit that you've developed that might be helpful for others to hear. Share it with us this hour. Or a little later, we want to talk about New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg's proposal to ban sugary drinks larger than 16 ounces from the city. Is this a good move, or is this an attack on personal freedom? Can we mandate healthy food, or at least ban unhealthy foods? Join our discussion, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. You can also give us a tweet at IPR Talk or give us a comment on our Facebook page. Let me start with you, Kathy, at the very basic foundation. How much can food choices impact our health?
Well, obviously, or at least obviously to me, they can impact them immensely. Choosing healthier foods over snack foods or vice versa, how much you choose to eat, all can make big impacts.
Ruth, tell us about your short list of key things to remember for healthy eating. Wow.
Okay, I'll give you my short list off my shirt. You know, I think if we look at the Dietary Guidelines for Americans, which is a very research science-based report that looks at what is all the research tells us, and it gives us some very basic messages. When you look at my plate, which is really the graphic representation of the Dietary Guidelines, fruits and vegetables should be half of our plate, and I think all of us are very aware that we're not meeting that recommendation. And so, you know, I think that's one very clear message, is that more fruits and vegetables is one of the key messages that we're trying to get across to all folks. Another one of the messages is that the grain should be a whole grain. And that's one of the big changes that's coming with the school meal changes that you talked about, is the movement towards the whole grains. And then the variety in our vegetables. It's another dietary guideline message. Just don't eat vegetables, but get the colors. Get the variety of colors on your plate. So if I were to look at, you know, the short list of three, I would look at increasing the fruits and vegetables to being half the plate, the variety of colors within that, and then the whole grains.
Okay, your short list. Thank you very much, Ruth. Let's talk about school lunch menus. They're changing under the federal Healthy Hunger-Free Kids Act. That law, signed by President Barack Obama in 2010, has the goal of reducing childhood obesity. More nutritious foods required by law now being phased in at public schools. The new standards must be in place by fall. So what will be the most noticeable changes, Ruth?
Oh, there's actually a few of them. And do keep in mind, some of the changes are actually being phased in over the next few years. But the things that they're going to see this fall, things that are required as of July 1, 2012, is you're going to see more fruits and vegetables. The requirements for fruit and vegetable has increased so that there's a greater quantity and selection. They are looking at those colors of the vegetables where there's a weekly requirement of the certain color groups of vegetables to include. They're also going to see a change in the milk that's being offered. They're going to be offering skim and 1%. 2% milk will not be in the schools starting this fall. And again, the whole grains. This fall, they're going to have half of all their grains be whole. And then in 2014, they're moving to all grains must be whole grain.
Okay. Do you anticipate any pushback when perhaps some parents see that their children are coming home complaining, perhaps because they don't like the taste of whole grain pasta or something like that, mm-hmm. breads?
And I believe there will be some, you know, there's going to be some challenges, and we're going to learn along the way here. But again, the changes in the school meals programs are, again, based upon those Dietary Guidelines for Americans and what we know impacts our overall health based on what we're eating. And it's going to take some time to change perceptions, to change attitudes, to change food preferences. You know, if an individual has never been exposed to certain types of fruits and vegetables or whole grains, you know, the common response is to kind of wrinkle your nose up at it. So one of the things that the school meals programs are doing a really good job at is trying to offer taste testing opportunities so the kids have an opportunity to try smaller amounts of these before they actually show up on the menu and actually engage the students in the process of maybe voting. You know, what are the new fruits and vegetables we want to put on our menus this year in the school district? So it is going to be a challenge of changing those perceptions and preferences, but there are some strategies that the schools are using to try and move that process along.
Kathy Garris, before being a dietitian for Hy-Vee in Iowa City, you also worked as a director of student nutrition at the Regina Education Center in Iowa City. You mentioned before we started that you've been moving in the direction of healthier foods, or schools have, before this mandate from the federal government. Comment on the challenges that Ruth just mentioned in getting kids on a healthier path.
Well, yeah. I mean, a lot of great schools have done some great things anticipating that this was going to be coming and trying to maybe switch some recipes and start adding in some whole grain flour or things like that, offering different products for kids, looking at whether they contain trans fats or not, and looking for alternatives. I think the food manufacturers for the school meal products have done a pretty good job of making those opportunities available, different products and things like that. So a lot of great food service directors out there. They have their finger on the pulse, and we all are concerned. We're concerned about our health. We're concerned about the kids that we serve,
right. And
want to try to do the best we can.
Ruth, I wonder if you can remind us a little bit about the immensity of this national epidemic, childhood obesity. Do you have some statistics on what has happened in the last couple of decades?
Mm-hmm. Well, if we look at the past 40 years, what we have seen is anywhere from a tripling to a quadrupling of the prevalence of obesity in various age groups. And then there are specific ethnic groups that are more predisposed to that. But we're looking at some of our age groups most of them are right between 15% and 20% of our 6 to 19-year-olds would be classified as obese. If we add in overweight, then we're looking at closer to 1 in 2. So we're talking about, 1 out of 5 approximately could be considered obese, and it's upwards of 1 out of 2 if you include overweight and obese.
Tremendous health implications. I was talking to a doctor at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, a pediatric doctor, as a matter of fact. Cases of 15-year-olds coming in with type 2 diabetes.
Yeah.
And then you probe a little bit to find their history. They'd been drinking 2 liters of soda a day.
Mm-hmm.
That's something you've heard of as well, Ruth.
Yes. Actually, I was at a professional meeting where they have documented cases of type 2 diabetes in 5-year-olds. We've had documented cases of children 12 years old having a gastric bypass surgery. We do have a number, the number growing of youth that are graduating from high school that might already be on antihypertensive medication, controlling their blood pressure, and or they might be on a medication to control type 2 diabetes. Yes, these are significant health concerns. And the reason that they are such a large concern is that they're what we refer to as the chronic diseases. They require constant management. It's not something that can be, quote, cured by a surgical intervention. And it's going to cause a lot of other health problems. You know, both the weight, the diabetes leads into things like joint replacements or maybe, impaired eyesight, neuropathies, things like that. And so those are the concerns, is not just the blood pressure and the type 2 diabetes, but then those lead to subsequent issues.
Talking about healthy eating this hour with Ruth Litchfield of Iowa State University and Kathy Garris, a dietitian for Hy-Vee in Iowa City. This tweet from one of our listeners, Mary, says, "Drink water. Sometimes I'll crave a snack and realize I'm just thirsty."
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Susan, that's a nice trick, a nice habit to pass along, Mary. 1-866-780-9100. Susan in Washington, Iowa. Hi, Susan. What do you have to
Hello.
Offer?
Hello. I just wanted to say that right before Christmas, my husband and I took a cruise, and that was the thing that was appalling to see, because I knew we needed to lose a little weight, but then I looked and I'm like, oh my gosh, what is happening to us as a people? And so since January, and my husband went and had his blood work done before, kind of to see where he was, we just started eating more whole foods. It's not a secret of how you do it. It's just more fruits and vegetables, and our plate will be more like 60% to 70% whole fruits and vegetables and salads and beans, and then maybe 20% animal products, and some meals we don't have any animal products at all. And I always exercised, but we do that maybe a little bit more. And he's lost over 50 pounds since January 1st, and I've lost about 30. Wow. And better than that is that we see this as our new lifestyle. And he's lost all his meds. His cholesterol dropped 100 points. His blood pressure's in normal range. And I just, we're healthier and happier. And it's not a miracle. It's just,
okay,
what whole foods.
It sounds like you're on a nice cycle that you're reinforcing each other, you're losing those pounds, the mental health is improving as well as your physical health. What is the key to others perhaps that you can offer, Susan, that is struggling to start that great cycle that you're on?
I think if you do it, if you have to do it by yourself, it's going to be a lot harder to get the support of your family and friends and start reading about it. And there's a book called Eat to Live that's really great. And there's a HBO series or a documentary called The Weight of the Nation, which is four parts, which is, I mean, it's horrifying. And there's one called The Fat, Sick, and Almost Dead. And you look at it and you go, that could be me.
Right.
And it's just not childhood obesity. It's all of it. And maybe, though, the childhood part, it's what's going to spark us to really get serious about it, because we hate to think that we're doing this to our kids. Mm-hmm.
Susan, thank you very much for the testimony.
Thank you.
I wish you continued good, healthy eating habits and continued luck in keeping that weight off. Eat to Live, a book that she mentioned. Any other resources people can go to motivate, to guide in those early steps? Ruth, let me start with you.
I would encourage that they seek out some healthcare professional in their local communities, particularly most of your hospitals will have a registered dietitian. And registered dietitians have a wealth of resources that would be available to those folks. And I think it's helpful to visit with a registered dietitian because they can personalize some of the recommendations more specifically for you in case you do have some pre-existing health conditions or you're taking some medications along that line. You don't want to take the bestseller off the shelf and think it applies to everyone, because we all have some unique needs based on our existing conditions and meds we might be using. So I'd encourage a little bit more personalized approach and visit with a registered dietitian. But, you know, there are a lot of great resources out there, but they would help pinpoint the ones that are best for you based on your situation.
Kathy, when people come to you for advice at Hy-Vee, as a dietitian at Hy-Vee, what are the biggest questions they have in having trouble getting started? Where do you find people need the most sort of prompting?
If they were looking at weight loss or
they've recognized they've come to a turning point when
right.
it comes to food in their lives.
Well, I do find that when people approach me about with that attitude that they're ready to go, and that's really encouraging. And so we usually what I do is, as Ruth mentioned, we try to make sure that their health status is appropriate and some of those kinds of things. But then we also I sit down with them and just kind of talk about where they're at now. And sometimes I can see some, like the child that was drinking the 2 liters of pop. And sometimes there are glaring things like that. Sometimes there aren't. And one of the things that inevitably I turn to is the Nouvel scoring system that we use at Hy-Vee.
Explain that quickly.
Essentially what it is a there's a Nouvel system that rates foods based on the nutrient content. And what they look at initially are the 30 top ingredient or 30 top nutrients that are important for human health. So that includes the vitamins, minerals, carbohydrates, proteins, fats, water, or not water, but sorry. Anyway, so they look at those components and then basically rate a food based on how much of that those components are in that food. And then they also look at the calories and that sort of thing. Then in addition to that, sometimes, as we know, things are added to foods that may cancel out the, if you will, the health benefits of the food by adding sugar, adding salt, or things like that. So all of those things are taken into consideration, and the information is run through an algorithm. And at the end, there's a number from 1 to 100, with the higher numbers, the closer to 100, would be the more nutritious or more nutrient-dense foods, and the foods that score lower would be less dense. They typically have a lot of calories but not a lot of nutrients. So those would be the foods we'd want to eat less often.
In a tweet from Matt, he says he likes the Nuval system at Hy-Vee, but Hy-Vee, he says, needs to do a better job of sorting products to make the Nuval system useful, especially when it comes to fake sugar. Just a comment I'll pass along.
Okay.
We have about 5 minutes left to go. Let me touch on this and get your thoughts because, of course, in the news, New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg is proposing, he's working to ban sugary drinks larger than 16 ounces from New York City's eateries, their street carts, their stadiums. That's moving forward, his push to do that. It's the first time a city has proposed such a ban, which the mayor says is necessary to combat the rise in obesity. What is your take on this move, Ruth Litchfield? Can we mandate this or at least ban unhealthy foods?
This really comes down to a debate on personal rights or human rights, personal choice issues, however you want to frame that. And I know that there's arguments on both sides. However, I would also like to share that, you know, when we think about community health or community health promotion, we usually talk about there's three levels of how we achieve that. And level one being where we create awareness about an issue. You know, sometimes people aren't going to make a change unless they know there's a problem. And so level one is where we say, okay, we need to create an awareness campaign, make people aware that there is a problem. Level two is where we actually provide strategies and techniques, education for that behavior change to occur or for them to modify whatever they can do to address the problem. But in level three, what we do is we make the environment such that it promotes that healthy behavior. And I think we're kind of at that point in the obesity epidemic and what we're doing to combat that is, you know, I think everyone's aware of the problem now. We've achieved that. And people know what types of behaviors they need to engage in to address it or combat the obesity. But we have what's been called an obesogenic environment. We have an environment that actually promotes obesity based on the types of food choices that are most prevalently available and in some cases tend to be less expensive. And we also have an environment that does not promote us to be physically active. So I do think it's important that we create the environment that supports making the right choice the easy choice, mm-hmm. Making those healthy food choices the easy choice, making it an easy choice to be more physically active. And so it's going to be a variety of environmental strategies such as this one. I'm not saying this one's the right or the wrong, but we do have a plethora of sugar-sweetened beverages out there that are readily available that have contributed to this problem. They're not the only issue, but part of it.
Right. I'm thinking of a child that grows up in a family. What chance does a child have who is really only ever offered soda pop as a beverage? Will we at some point hold parents accountable as risking their child's health for these decisions?
Boy, I think you need to take that one to the legislature and to the Supreme Court. I don't know.
Good luck with that.
We have just a minute or two left. Kathy, your thoughts on this whole discussion?
Well, I guess when I first heard that, I sort of laughed a little bit because, and it's not a funny situation at all, but I thought, well, good luck. I know dietitians sometimes get a bad rap for being the food police, and I try to tell people, you know, we're trying to help you make better choices. We're trying to give you the information, put it there to help you make those choices that are going to help you and your family be healthier. And negative things usually aren't as successful. So we've got to, but we need to turn it around somehow.
Right. Negative things aren't as successful. But if we look at the testimony we heard on the phone here, fear is the factor that often gets us.
In some cases, yes.
To change our diets after decades of poor eating. Quick question for you. I know they're involved in kids' cooking classes, Kathy. Are kids better cooks today or a generation or two ago? Have we forgotten that art? Passing it on?
Yeah. I mean, and I'm working with three, four, and five-year-olds. So what we do is loosely called cooking. But what I do try to do is just continually expose kids to healthy foods, what they taste like without additives and sugar and salt.
Kathy Garris, dietitian for Hy-Vee in Iowa City. Ruth Litchfield, associate professor in the Department of Food Science and Human Nutrition at Iowa State University, also with ISU Extension. Ruth and Kathy, thank you so much for this conversation this half hour. It's been delightful. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Catherine Perkins and Alex Hoyer. Production assistance today from Lindsay Moon. Technical support from Dennis Reese. In Des Moines, we had help from, I think, Rick Fredrickson. Thank you, Rick. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Jeff Schmidt. Podcasting and on-demand audio, River to River, available at iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.